Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Today we're going to be looking at the post-war world of railways, which is going to take us a while because in a sense that culminates with the present day. So this is going to be a slower movement because we're actually drawing to the present day. And most of our experiences of rail, apart from for the very elderly, are in fact based on the period since 1945. And it's within that context that suppositions are made. So as listeners may know, I'm fascinated with James Bond. And the film From Russia with Love, 1963, a very formative film for many of us who were young at that period, included a lengthy rail journey for James Bond by train from Istanbul. One that was indirectly based on the experience of Ian Fleming, the author of the 1957 novel of that title. Having visited Istanbul for an Interpol conference in 1955, Fleming had travelled home by the Orient Express, though he disliked it as it lacked a restaurant car, and in his own copy of the novel he recorded, quote, "The Orient Express is a dull, dirty train," which of course, for 1955, a period of post-war poverty on the whole, particularly in Eastern Europe, was a reasonable assessment. Or again, if one goes to Japanese writings set in 1947, The Devil's Flute Murders saw its protagonist take, quote, "a semi-express bound for Kobe," that's leaving Tokyo for Kobe, quote, "feeling half crushed to death. Even getting a train ticket was no mean feat. Found himself squeezed into this sardine can of a train car, looking like a crumpled handkerchief, 2 hours late." Rail more generally was exhausted in 1945, and certainly so in Britain. There, it had been employed with enormous energy, persistence, diligence, and courage during the war, much of it under German air attack, but it was clapped out, as Hugh Dalton, the Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, noted in Parliament on the 17th of December 46, when defending the government's policy of rail nationalisation. Across the world, the future of rail had been made an even more urgent issue in 45 than it had been prior to the war, when it had had many difficulties in the period of the Great Depression, in part due to extensive wartime damage, but also due to the need to respond to several years of inadequate investment and maintenance other than for immediate purposes linked to the war effort, and sometimes not even for those. Then there was the requirement, in effect, as well to demobilise rail systems in 1945, in other words, to switch them from wartime purposes to peacetime processes, while at the same time enabling them to handle a range of acute and immediate issues, including the movement of millions of victims and refugees, such as ethnic German expellees from Eastern Europe in 1945-6, as well as the supply of provision to people such as the Dutch population who were severely malnourished as a result of German policies. It was also necessary to make the systems fit for peacetime purposes, which in Eastern Europe, China, North Korea and North Vietnam including the ambitions of the communist regimes that seized power. Now, as wartime damage was repaired, there was much essential restoration, both of the earlier networks, but also of as many of the services as could be reintroduced. This task involved formidable effort against a background of major shortages of resources and coal, and in the face of severe competition. However, the restoration was eased in many countries by labour availability, much of it from conscripted wartime soldiers operating still in peacetime, including also, as in China, from prisoners of war, in the case of China, Japanese prisoners of war. Across much of Europe and East Asia, this restoration involved repairing wartime damage that was far more extensive, sustained, than that of the First World War because of heavier bombing. East Asia, North Africa, and much of Greece and Italy had not been damaged by direct conflict in World War I, but the situation was very different in World War II. As well as that, much of the station infrastructure was badly damaged in Europe and East Asia, as were marshalling yards and bridges. Temporary replacements, which were often army-built wartime expedients, were also installed post-war and then had to be replaced by more permanent ones with better safety margins. There was also the acute disruption attendant upon territorial changes. For example, in Europe, in the case of Poland's borders with both Germany and the Soviet Union. In addition, and to an extent that's often forgotten, there was post-war conflict. For example, resistance to the imposition of Soviet control, particularly in Ukraine, the Baltic Republics, and Poland. And these conflicts underlined the continued vulnerability of rail to sabotage and attack, as well as, in fact, the military purposes of many railways. There were also civil wars in China, Greece, and the Philippines between 1946 and 1954, all of which involved significant damage to railways, as well as the birth of the Cold War and anti-imperial conflicts in that period, especially in Korea, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Malaya. Conflict of a different sort, but often overlapping because of the political direction emanating ultimately from the Soviet Union, was seen in labor disputes, as in France in 1953, when the socialist and communist trade unions used a dispute over terms and conditions, both to compete with each other and to challenge the government. Rail was a significant consideration in the Cold War, seen as important to the deployment of forces and vulnerable to disruption. Returning to James Bond, Ian Fleming's first Bond story, Casino Royale, written in 1952 and published in 1953, centered on an attempt to end pro-Soviet subversion in the French rail industry. There was certainly an anxiety about a political dimension to industrial disputes in the railway industry, which in the period 1946 to 60, these disputes were serious in a number of states, including Britain, France, and for example, in French West Africa, notably Senegal and the Ivory Coast. Authoritarian states crushed strikers, notably in Ethiopia. In communist states, there was also a determination to ensure only union activists who conformed to regime views. Politics involved priorities as well in provision and therefore expenditure. So narratives that do not include political factors are suspect, and indeed much of the history of rail as conventionally produced is rather suspect for that reason. Thus, linked to restoration, there was an attempt post-war to improve services in accordance with both technological potential and politico-cultural priorities, for example, the use of diesel-powered locomotives and separately the expansion of electrification. Both of these were seen as sources of modernity and modernization. There was a, as it were, political and cultural reaction against steam that owed partially to technological advantages, and diesel and electrification definitely had them, but also to these political cultural factors. Diesel locomotives came into widespread use in America from the late 1930s. And just to remind you, a diesel is in effect an electric locomotive carrying its own power plant, whereas electrification and electric trains refer to the provision of electricity either through overhead cables or from a third rail on the track bed. Diesels initially lacked the horsepower output of steam locomotives, which caused problems on gradients, but they were easier to maintain and refuel, had fewer labour needs, and appeared modern, and as such appropriate for states moving into such fields as nuclear power. Regular use indeed of diesel locomotives began in Britain in 1947, which was particularly useful because there were major pressures on coal supplies post-war and much coal was of low quality. The Railway Modernisation Plan of 1955 in Britain noted, many factors combine to indicate that the end of the steam era is at hand, including the insistent demand for a reduction in air pollution by locomotives and for greater cleanliness in trains and railway stations. Again, the image of modernity was important. Of course, as we may well know, diesel itself produces pollution, but the point was the image of steam was the image of the past. It was an image that could be rejected in a rail industry that was nationalizing under Labour and where the left was heavily invested in ideas of electrification equals modernity. Across the world, the choice of electrification for particular lines was predicated not only on the availability and cost of energy sources, but also prioritization of specific services. Improvements after 1945 in India, for example, which gained independence in 47, included network extension, but also double tracking and line electrification. Across the world, rail tracks became more reliable with the use of welded in place of jointed track from the 1940s and more universally by the 1960s. If you turn, interestingly, to Japan, the electrification of the existing Japanese lines continued into the 1970s. And at the same time, urbanization led to the spread of suburban railways. The business opportunities for rail shifted from industrial areas to these suburban ones. And again, there was a particular business model, and the business models that provide profitability for rail are always worth thinking about. So in the case of Japan, the railway companies owned the housing development company, the department store company, the supermarket chain company, and often a baseball team and amusement parks in particular developments. And indeed, this goes on to be the case, and they raise income comprehensively in their business area, exploiting to the full the opportunity offered by the inflow of population that comes from their commuting possibilities. However, instructively, in Japan, the spread of road use hit the viability of non-high-speed, non-suburban lines, notably in remote areas from the 60s, as indeed did the movement of people to the major cities. So in other words, a crisis not too different from the beaching crisis in Britain. In addition, the decline in scale of the coal and steel industries hit some of the industrial lines in Japan. And as a result, there was pressure in Japan between sort of political constituencies which didn't want their rail provision cut and obviously the rail company, Japan Railways, which was well aware of the difficulties posed. Turning from Japan, a developed system, rail system, and albeit a still developing one after World War II and to this day, if you look at the colonial empires of the late 40s and 50s, there was also post-war expansion in the rail network, but none of the imperial powers, of which the two major ones were Britain and France, there was also, of course, Portugal and Spain, none of them had a large amount of money to spend. Plans to make mineral shipments easier were the usual reason why rail services with it were introduced. So, for example, If you take Burkina Faso, as we now call it, it used to be called Upper Volta, a major manganese deposit was discovered there in 1959. This led to plans for rail expansion. But in there, and this remains the case to this day, despite repeated plans for such extension, scant progress was made. Instead, there was a continued reliance on lorries operating on poor roads that, far from being all weather, encountered serious problems in the wet season. It was the same for countries that were not colonies, for example, Brazil. Returning to a colonial power, Britain, the British scheme of 1947 to 51 to develop large-scale groundnut, we would say peanut, cultivation in Tanganyika, modern-day Tanzania, was envisaged as a way to produce fats, a key food source for Britain and employment, but it was totally misconceived and mismanaged, almost a cliche of the failure of labour economic planning after the war. The scheme included initially the development of the harbour of Dar es Salaam, an extensive use of the central line for which more freight wagons were ordered. But subsequently, a new line, the narrow gauge Southern Province Railway, was opened in 1949, expanded in 1954 and 58, and closed in 1963. It was not viable, and the scheme was not viable. It's interesting that you get so little attention devoted to these failures when people write as if rail was always the answer. In 1960-65, comparably, there were plans to extend the Djibouti Addis Ababa line going from the coast to Ethiopia, but these were not pursued. And indeed, in 2008, service ended most of the line between Addis Ababa, and many of the rails were stolen. Resource-linked rail expansion and activity was also to be true as well. So, you know, there was failure, but there was also success. For example, with post-colonial states such as Cameroon and Mauritania. Due to decolonization, however, rail projects were suspended or called into doubt. Former imperial powers generally continued to provide a measure of support to their ex-colonies, but this was not always the case, as with France and Guinea from independence in 1958. Political independence, however, was not necessarily itself the key element of change. Indeed, whereas colonial governments frequently had an arm's length relationship with non-state mineral producers, this was often not the case with individual states that were often open to partnerships. The latter could provide the liquidity necessary for investment. Less positively, there could be large-scale corruption, a situation that continues to the present day. Although one would be naive not to be aware that you can have large-scale corruption in the train systems of developed states. Geopolitical considerations were far less to the fore for rail than had been the case in the Great Age of Empire. Instead, air dominated attention, and notably so for America, which replaced Britain as the leading source of liquidity and influence across much of the world. American geopolitical concerns and means were not centered on rail links and their construction. Instead, there was the desire for a global network of air bases, the links in between coming from air transport and, where necessary, by sea. Open skies agreements were the civilian equivalent for the Americans. Rail, meanwhile, was in serious trouble in its heartlands, if we think of both Britain and America in that fashion. Hugh Dalton, again, speaking in the House of Commons in December 1946, said, quote, "If we left the railways open to the full blast of the free, unfettered competition of road transport, the whole railway system within a few years would be totally bankrupt," which raised the question about how much cross-subsidy was sensible. Across much of the non-communist world, the rapid increase in car ownership proved a serious problem for short and long-term rail services. This was noticeably so in those prosperous countries where cars became ubiquitous, most particularly America, where losses on passenger services reached $723 million in 1957, a formidable sum for the period, but also in Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Freight services, meanwhile, were hit by lorries, in part because of their lack of flexibility compared to roads, not least as manufacturing became less focused on large factories fed by rail-borne coal. Road transport was helped by the availability of low-cost oil until 1973, the OPEC crisis. Now, rail freight had done relatively well in America during the war, and indeed, rail continued important, but there was a relative decline. So, for example, in 1958, rail still carries 46% of freight ton miles in America, but it had been 75% in 1929. In 1955, President Dwight Eisenhower supported a plan for the federal funding of interstate roads, pressing for a vast system of interconnected highways crisscrossing the country. Interstates, with their steadier and more predictable travel time, offered opportunities to challenge the rail position in long-distance freight movement. Hitherto, lorries were more significant only over short distances. The Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 was a key development. There had been such an act in 1944, but that act hadn't included funding provisions. The 56 Act did. Road freight was increasingly important for higher value goods, as well as making inroads in less valuable ones. And road competition was a crucial challenge to rail profitability, as it led to less of a margin to increase charges to reflect greater costs. Now, this was not only the case in America, but America was particularly important given its key role in the rail industry, not least that the rail companies there were being hit hard in liquidity and therefore not able to invest in rail developments elsewhere. The bankruptcy of major American rail companies, notably the Penn Central, the merger of the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central in 1970, led to the establishment that year of Amtrak, a government-funded body that took over intercity passenger services in 1971, and also Contrail, the Consolidated Railway Corporation, a public body running from 1976, which was responsible for the lines of many bankrupt companies. Amtrak was a quasi-public for-profit corporation, but it depended on political support in Congress, which led to inefficiencies, including running costly lines, notably in the South and West, although many services still were cut back. Thus, Las Vegas Station was demolished in 1971. I know, Graham, when you go to Las Vegas, you go straight to the gambling tables, but you should go and look at the railway station and what was there. It was replaced by a small waiting room in the hotel built on the site. And in 1997, that itself was closed with the end of the Amtrak service to the city. And that had been a fairly major service, fairly important when the gambling industry developed. Amtrak's far-flung network meant a constant need for federal subsidies, as well as a substantial repair backlog. Amtrak's separation from the private sector, both in financial and operational terms, made it harder to raise funds and to introduce efficiencies. In addition, the political tensions between state and federal governments and agencies didn't help. Obsolescence, indeed, was cumulative. Thus, in 2017, Amtrak's president, Charles Moorman, told the New Jersey state legislature, quote, The railroad is not, and frankly never has been, in a true state of good repair, meaning that many of the assets that make up the infrastructure are past the point at which they would normally be replaced. And that was part and parcel of the Amtrak responding to criticisms when there were accidents and when there were disruption through delays. And Amtrak's argument always was there was underinvestment, whereas its critics argued there was poor management. I think actually the case is underinvestment. I think that's a reasonable one. Technological changes, meanwhile, provided rail with opportunities, notably in the shape of containers. They had been used already with railways in the 19th century, the Liverpool and Manchester Railway moving coal in rectangular timber boxes transferred by carts. In the early 20th century, closed container boxes were in use, and in 1921, the American Post Office contracted with the New York Central Railroad to move mail in containers. The Philadelphia Railroad began regular container services in 1928, opening a container terminal at Enola in 1932. The carriage of containers on flat cars became more common from the mid-1930s. And in 1951, a Western European railway standard was developed. Container ships followed from the 1950s, and then double-stacked rail transport from 1977, with America the innovator and China a key copier, which is, you know, a fairly common practice. The world's first container ship's maiden voyage was in April 1956. Now, as far as freight was concerned, containerization required investment in new freight facilities, but it increased the speed and cut the cost of freight movements, greatly raised labor productivity on the railways, and changed the nature of marshalling yards. Furthermore, interoperability with ships and lorries rapidly improved. Linked to this, the deregulation provided by the Staggers Rail Act in 1980 helped make the American freight system profitable, indeed highly profitable in the case of many lines, and thus attracting considerable investment. For example, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, a major company owned by the Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated, had revenues, in other words, Buffett, had revenues of over $5 billion in 2017. In the meantime, the government freight system had cut its network and was successfully privatized in 1987 by the Reagan government. In 2022, the leading American railways, in terms of annual freight wagons, were in order the Burlington Company and Union Pacific, both with over 8 million freight wagons used, then Northern Southern and CSX Transportation, both with over 6 million, and then Canadian National, Canadian Pacific, and Kansas City Southern. Both the Canadian railways bid to take over Kansas City Southern, which indicated the value of the rail industry in commercial terms. There was no need here to be looking at a large-scale state investment. The 2015 congressional hearing on the Staggers Act noted that since then, quote, the railroad industry has become more efficient, productive, and profitable. Well, that sounds all to the good. It's also worth noting some of the testimony. So, for example, the testimony from the American Chemistry Council, in other words, representing those industries involved in the chemicals, opposed what it called a re-regulation of the rail industry, but was also worried by the extent to which less competition meant higher charges. And indeed, I think that's very indicative for Britain. a lot of people naively assume that nationalisation is necessarily better. It can actually mean no competition, and therefore that poses all sorts of issues. On the other hand, the rail industry representative at the 2015 congressional hearing emphasised the investment made possible by profit. Quote, "We are preferring for tomorrow today all over the country, expanding into nodal terminals, double tracking hundreds of miles of track, installing millions of new rail ties, upgrading signal systems, and building new major rail yards." Although American train derailments fell from about nearly 800 annually in 2000 to 2006 to fewer than 400 annually from 2015, there were still issues with accidents. I mean, this year alone, there's been the derailment in Ohio of a Norfolk Southern train carrying toxic chemicals, and in Minnesota of a train carrying ethanol, which is also flammable and toxic. Now, with America setting the norms of Western society, its combination of suburbanization, low fuel costs, car parts and repair prices, and the very ready availability of them all, plus a failure to provide new rail passenger capacity, hit rail travel hard. In other words, there is cheap road transport and there is a lack of new rail passenger capacity. There were low gas taxes, we would call them petrol taxes, and massive state support from the 1950s for road building with the Interstate Highway Program. These roads ensured that inexpensive bus services could provide, such as Greyhound, could provide competition for rail, not only locally, but also long distance. This interacting system of advantages from road availability then became influential in countries that followed the American example, such as New Zealand, where Auckland's the major centre, developed as a road-based city. Meanwhile, advertising proved particularly important to the spread of the road model, and it was a sphere in which most rail systems, particularly nationalized ones, found it difficult to compete. In democracies, rail lacked the lobbying and popular appeal of road, and locomotive manufacturing lacked the lobbying and popular appeal of car companies and factories. Everybody in Britain in the 1970s had a view on British Leyland, the dire car manufacturing company. Nobody really seemed to care about the situation in rail. Indeed, car companies and factories attracted state support in a way that locomotive manufacturing did not. It proved a key competition in large countries such as America, Australia, and Canada. And while internal air services also provided competition in smaller countries, including Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and New Zealand. I used to live in Newcastle, and from Newcastle to London, there was quite strong competition between rail and air for commuters. As in Japan, these in part involved links between separate islands, but again, as in Japan, most of the competition was within the main island. Now, next time we're going to go on with Britain, and we're going to look at, obviously, the background to beaching and the consequences. But I want at this moment to just consolidate a bit and then take some questions from Graham on the American case, because in a way, America, the headline story in America is of the large-scale demise, apart from in key suburban areas and in the subsidized Boston to Washington corridor, of most passenger services. But on the other hand, what people are apt to forget is the continued vitality and crucially profitability of rail freight. So I wonder, Graham, if you've got any particular questions on this point.
Well, I have. You've covered a lot of ground, Professor Black, and I really want to start with perhaps using America as a case study, comparing European railways after the war, the 20 years or so after the Second World War, with America, because firstly, as you said at the beginning the podcast, you said about the nature of how run down European railways were as a result of the degradations of warfare. Many of those economic models were to nationalize the railway services, whereas in the 20 years after the Second World War in America, the private companies were still running railways. Invariably involved some generalizations, but what can we say was similar or different between the American experience, which wasn't nationalized until the 1970s, and the experience in Europe, where those companies were nationalized, which seems to have acted better in the interests of railways?
Well, that's a very, that's in a way the key question. And it's also bound up with that last remark, which is a very interesting one, in the interests of railways, because in a sense, people tend to think that that is an unproblematic, that the interests are represented by scale and, and if anything, the increase in scale. Whereas what I would suggest is that, what one's got in part is a question of profitability. And I'm not sure one can really, argue that there is a, how should one put it, that there is an obvious measure of rail value. So whenever I say to people, you shouldn't assume that a heavily subsidized rail system is, for the best, and that, you have to think about what else that money could be spent on. And even if you're just looking at commuting, and even if you're just looking at state-financed and controlled commuting, it might be, or subsidized, it might well be the case that buses are better, you would get the most horrified response. and it's very, very funny in some respects. But it's also disturbing because it's part and parcel of the kind of way that so often people have confirmation bias in terms of what they seem as appropriate. Now, clearly, we know that in a crowded country like ours, you don't want to do without a rail system. But that doesn't mean that there is any particular sage that came down the equivalent of Mount Sinai holding a tablet of stone saying it had to be of a certain size. And one of the problems is that people frequently discuss matters as if that was the case.
Well, I mean, I'm interested particularly that remark from Hugh Dalton, Clement Attlee's Chancellor of the Exchequer, about the dangers of unfettered road travel and how damaging it would be to the railways. When you have governments which have a Ministry of Transport, which therefore combines these competing calls for investment between building roads and subsequently motorways or investing in the railways, when you have one ministry trying to satisfy different demands, so what really were the tensions there? Can you see occasions when really the governments were prioritizing the railways or moving away from doing so because they actually thought the future might be on road rather than rail?
Well, I think that's a very, very, very interesting question. I mean, I think there's a number of things that one can say here. One is, you're treating, I mean, we all do this, Graham. We all do this. I do it myself. We treat government as an abstraction. But let us put it like this. One of the great dangers for any process of governance is the capture by producer lobbies, so that in practice, government then becomes a way to divert state resources to their benefit. So universities are, as it were, for the benefit of university administrators, the military for the benefit of, as it were, military politicians. We tend to generally call them generals. And in the case of railways, clearly, if you were thinking about long service bureaucrats who were very much entrenched in a certain set of values and priorities. Now, these were not necessarily bad people. In some countries, as with any producer lobby, you're always going to get a certain degree of corruption, etc., etc. But it's not so much corruption that is the major problem, it's conceit. It is the assumption that their set of values is the only way to think about transport or how to defend the country or how to run a university and so on and so forth. And I think that that is where one has difficulties. We've got to be very, very cautious about assuming that those who set up the rail service were necessarily doing so in the most sensible of fashions. Now, if you take Britain, we're going to be talking about Britain, but very briefly, you could argue, as I have argued, that the existing rail provision was exhausted and that there was a need for fresh investment, and that there was problems of securing that investment. All true. I mean, you might also point out that in an era of very high taxation, which Labour introduced in the late 40s, you're crowding out other sources of investment, but we'll leave that to one side. What you could then say is one of the problems with the state takeover is because, as it were, they don't wish to then fall out with the trade unions, who are very strongly entrenched in the Labour Party, you're not going to get the provision of adequate worker discipline. And I mean, you've got instead what used to be called, maybe still is called Spanish practices, which for the benefit of listeners who are not British, or indeed for most British listeners, is a way to refer to